This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and develop your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. In this episode, we talk with the president of California Aeronautical University, which provides degree-level programs focused on students who want to become professional pilots. We also talk about airlines and jet fuel prices, the new FAA rules for commercial use of small unmanned aircraft systems, Flight 804 data recorders, and the impacts of Brexit on aviation. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 407 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. With me is Brian Coleman, our associate producer and high mileage co-host. Hey, Brian.
High mileage, huh?
Yeah. You do put on a lot of miles. How many miles do you have now?
I do. Most of my flying is, of course, on United, and I crossed the 75,000 mile mark coming back from DC. So,
wow.
Yeah, but I'm grounded-ish for the next 2 weeks.
All right. So that means we've got your participation for a couple of weeks.
Yep.
Great. Also with us is Max Trescott, the other Max, Max West. He's a CFI, an author, and a glass cockpit expert. Hey, Max.
Hey, hello, Max, and fellow co-hosts and listeners around the world. I have got to tell you, today's a special day for me. It's my 35th anniversary, so
wow. I'm
pretty thrilled. Yep,
exactly. Congratulations. So,
congratulations.
And it's such a good relationship, I was allowed to come on the show here tonight.
Yeah, that's key.
Happily, I'll find out after our recording that it's, you know, I'm still set up for my 36th anniversary. Right.
So. We hope so.
But, yeah, exactly. But it's been fun, and, you know, it kind of makes me smile to think about it.
All right. Also with us is our favorite aviation historian, David Vanderhoof.
Thanks, Max. I want to give a shout out to everybody who came out last weekend. It was an awesome event in D.C., and it's just amazing every year doing it. So I'm still recovering from that, but we're looking forward to another great show this evening.
Our other host, Rob Mark, is, we think he's not joining us because of some work commitments, although as we were saying before, you never know. Rob might pop in, but if he does, we'll introduce him then.
Hello?
Yeah. Who did that? That was a good imitation.
Well, that was good. I was going to say, that's better than mine.
That was good.
I thought I would try it.
Try to fill in. That's good.
Exactly.
Well, our guest this episode is Matt Johnston. He's the president of the California Aeronautical University. Now, Matt has over 20 years' experience in serving education. He began working for Santa Barbara Business College, a career technical college. More recently, Matt's focused his experience and interest in aviation to develop California Aeronautical University. Now, this university offers associate and bachelor degree level programs. They're focused on students earning their degree to become a professional pilot. Matt has earned Part 141 private, instrument, commercial, CFI, CFII approvals for the university, including graduates having the eligibility to obtain a restricted ATP at the reduced hours of 1,000 for bachelor's degree studies or 1,250 for associate degree students. This is from the otherwise required 1,500-hour minimum for non-degree aviation-trained pilots. Matt also serves as the vice president of the Wings Over Camarillo Association. That's the organization that coordinates an annual air show. He also participates in a number of other aviation-related associations, including the University Aviation Association, the Regional Airline Association, AOPA, EAA, with the Young Eagles program. So, Matt, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Well, thanks for having me. It sounds like it's going to be a fun podcast. Hi, Miles, and all the introductions here. Looking forward to it.
It's always fun, Matt. It's always fun. Now, Santa Barbara Business College, that's the university's sister institution, correct? And that opened way back in 1886. But when did the California Aeronautical University open?
Santa Barbara Business College, actually 1888 is when we were founded. And so over 125 years of history there. And then we founded California Aeronautical University just about a year ago. Once we had developed our aeronautical programs within the SBB College family, we came across a facility that I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit later that just made it a perfect venue for us to develop California Aeronautical University and offer what we're able to offer to the community today.
We are really looking forward to learning from Matt how you started university, but also specifically about the programs and the value that that they bring. But before we do that, we have a little bit of aviation news to go over. So I'll ask, is everyone ready?
Ready.
Ready from the West.
Ready.
Our first story comes from Skift. This is big U.S. airlines realize they missed a shot at cheapest jet fuel prices in 12 years. This is interesting. According to this article, jet fuel prices are up as much as 80% since January, which kind of surprised me. Max T, are you seeing, now this is jet fuel, but are you seeing aviation fuel prices up? I mean, I thought gasoline prices were down.
Well, so most of what I see is avgas, and that never does anything except go up. You know, there's such small volumes of this made. But jet fuel, you know, the prices that we would see retail have been pretty stable. I think the prices that the airlines get are significantly lower than what we'd see at retail. I'm seeing retail prices for jet fuel in the, you know, the $350 range, and yet we've seen that the airlines have, you know, purchased in the past for, a buck and a quarter or something like that. So they get quite a good deal. But then again, you know, they buy with huge volumes.
Yeah, the article points out that jet fuel was trading from less than 80 cents back in January and now trading at $1.32 a gallon. And so that's obviously a huge percentage increase. Of course, when you start talking about jet fuel, you end up talking about fuel hedging. And I think this is what the article is sort of pointing out, that the airlines missed, I guess, an opportunity to lock in lower prices at the beginning of the year. But, you know, fuel hedging, any kind of hedging is really risky. It's always easy, I think, to be critical after the fact, when you know whether the price went up or went down. I mean, if the price had gone down, you could have a similar article saying that they hedged when they shouldn't have. In any event, I think this has a big impact on airline profits, no doubt.
Yeah, like for example, United, that only lost $138 million this past quarter.
Well, I think they lost, not just United, but the industry lost billions collectively last year with fuel hedging. So they had burned pretty badly. So I could see why they might have decided, yeah, let's stop trying to gamble, which is really what it is. In a market where you have continually rising prices, pretty easy to figure out how to hedge. But when it's volatile, you know, nobody can tell for sure what to do.
Yeah, and I was just wondering with Matt, how do you guys handle fuel and fuel prices? And if you can say, what do you pay?
What we do is we work with the local field operators, fuel providers, and negotiate a end-of-plane rate that fluctuates with the market. So it's still below market that you'd get on field to pass that on to our students, but it's just an end-of-plane rate from the providers.
Well, I think Max West, I think as you characterize it, is gambling. I mean, that's, I think, really what it is. And sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. Hopefully you come out ahead more often than you come out behind, but it's a game. It's hard to do that.
Well, I think the bottom line is prices are still dramatically lower than they were, you know, say a year ago. So the airlines are still winning, at least from the, you know, the cost of fuel side. But, you know, some of the airlines are losing from low fuel prices because there's a lot less energy exploration going on. So they're not selling as many business class and first class tickets to, you know, the energy companies. So, you know, it's not necessarily a win-win for airlines.
All right. We also had kind of a major event this past week with the DOT and the FAA finalizing the rules for small unmanned aircraft systems, small drones. And David and I, of course, spent the entire last episode over at the UAV Digest episode 151 talking about this. And we don't want to repeat all of it here. But for those that don't follow us at the UAV Digest, maybe a few highlights. What this is these are the rules. This is adds a new part 107, and the scope of this is, as we said, small UAS. So these are small drones. Small meaning less than 55 pounds, which doesn't sound gigantically small. But it does set some operational limitations, things like requiring a visual line of sight. Now, again, this is for commercial operations. This is not for hobbyist or recreational uses. Flying during daylight hours, actually, or twilight, as it turned out. Not flying over people. Visual line of sight only. Those are some of the high points. David, what else is there? Of course, there's the certification of pilots and the establishment of a new position, the remote pilot in command.
That was one of the surprising things is the terminology now was pilot in command, which was good. The other thing was you're not allowed to fly in Class B, C, D, and E airspace, which both Max and I reversed accidentally on the last show. But you can fly with ATC permission, so you need to call your local control tower. And we've had, surprisingly, a lot of successful people emailing us and sending us copies of their certificates showing that they've already passed the proficiency test for the 107, and now all they got to wait till August to get their license or their rating. So it's interesting. One of the things we talked about, Max, and you will agree with this is an incremental process.
Right.
This is just the beginning. There, you can't fly beyond line of sight. There's absolutely no way that you can package delivery across states or do an inlet because you can't fly across states. So there's a lot of detail. What I suggest you do is take a half hour, even if you're not into UAVs, but you're a pilot, this does directly affect you. So take a half hour and go listen to us on UAV Digest on Friday.
There's something that flight instructors can do that came out of this as well, too. You guys happen to see what that was?
For flight instructors?
Yeah.
What's that?
So I actually have new authority under this, and I'm not kidding. For licensed pilots, so someone who has a private or, you know, commercial or something like that, they can get the remote pilot certificate merely by going on to iacra.faa.gov. Putting in an application, and then I, as a CFI, am one of the categories of people who are allowed to authorize that. So pilots have kind of a shortcut to the front of the line. Basically, it's just an application process, and a flight instructor, a designated examiner, and a few other categories of folks, certainly an FAA inspector, can authorize it. And, you know, that gets you the temporary remote pilot certificate within 10 days.
Very good.
Matt, at the university, are you teaching any?
Yeah, I was going to say all this direction is good for everyone because what guidance we had before, it was hard to make investments into programs into the future as yes. far as where people were going to go and what career outcomes they had, largely with the bigger, you know, greater than 55-pound UAVs. But this definitely starts the path forward, like someone said, incremental. So that's good.
Right. And this is for small UAVs only. So it's 55 pounds would be out of the league. But and the other important thing was the FAA decided that there didn't need to be a micro UAS category, which we had been talking about. So,
or at least not yet.
Not yet.
Yeah, okay. We're likely going to see another NPRM for a micro, you know, UAV category. The FAA received a lot of comments through their NPRM process concerning small drones and the fact that, you know, these are low-risk kinds of aircraft and so really should be exempt from almost any kind of rules. But the FAA decided that there really are a lot of issues here to kind of flesh out, and they really need input from the general public. So they say that maybe later this year we may see an NPRM for that category. Also, David mentioned August. The effective date is not precisely known. The rule first has to be published in the Federal Register, and then there's a 60-day period. Many people are predicting that means by sort of late into August is when we may see this rule implemented.
So Amazon's not going to start flying next week?
No. In terms of package delivery, it's very restricted. As David mentioned, the FAA was trying to arrive at rules that would not trip the air carrier regulations that are out there, where you're carrying property for compensation. So it's extremely limited. As David mentioned, no crossing state lines, because that turns into interstate commerce, which is a hurdle. Another issue with this is that because this mandates line of sight or visual line of sight only, well, that makes long distance package delivery kind of a problem, at least under Part 107. Now, there will be a process for waivers. Many of the requirements in Part 107 are, if this is a word, are waivable upon application to the FAA, but that process isn't really worked out yet. So the bottom line for package delivery at this point, commercial package delivery, is very limited. Maybe the possibility for some flexibility there, but I think it really doesn't happen until full automation enters into the rule structure. And so, as David says, as he mentioned, this is incremental. This is a first step. There are many, many more steps to come, I think.
Well, I saw that 107 cleverly includes the FAA catch-all rule for regular pilots. That's 91.13, careless or reckless operation, which basically means even if you don't break a rule, if you do something dumbass stupid, they're going to come after you under that particular rule. So, hopefully people realize that and continue to try and be good citizens and not just do dumb stuff, even though it might be technically allowed.
And that applies to model aircraft, too. Right, David?
Absolutely. It's kind of the other codification that came out of this was, yes, model aircraft and model rocketry are regulated by their governing bodies, which would be the Academy of Model Aeronautics and the National Model Rocket Association. However, while they don't need to have licenses or follow it, does mean that you decide to fly your radio-controlled airplane into somebody's house, you're going to have a discussion with the FAA. They are responsible for the airspace. And that was ambiguous before, because basically Congress said you're not supposed to go anywhere near model aircraft. And the FAA said, but they fly, so we have to do that with UAVs. Well, now they've said that you're not responsible. You don't need to go get your certificate if you're flying a radio controlled airplane, because there's a governing body, the Academy of Model Aeronautics, that has standards for you to subscribe to. That being said, you do something dumbass stupid, as my other co-host said. I wanted to use that twice. the FAA can levy fines and have a discussion with you. So.
Yeah, I want to see that phrase defined somewhere, though. What is exactly dumbass stupid?
No.
Have you been reckless? I was going to say, have you been following the UAV Digest for the last year? We have one of those weekly.
Yeah, you know it when you see it.
It's our usual grounded segment.
Yep. Matt, do you have any unmanned aviation courses or curricula at the California Aeronautical University yet?
Yeah, currently we do not, but I'll tell you where this is largely popular. It's in some of these high school academy programs, and we're working with several high schools, and they build UAVs and go out and work with the students to demonstrate and show them, what the potential is with UAVs. And for all these programs, it's great that there's more definition, and ultimately there's going to be more opportunity there for people that have an aviation interest to get into flying something.
Yes, absolutely.
And do you see that transitioning into Max and I have both said that this could be a gateway drug to aviation, flying drones, and then moving on into general aviation, et cetera, or other careers. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, we're seeing that in the high school students right now. I mean, they just see they see something taking off, and back in the days when we'd try to fly a model aircraft, I never had the aptitude of flying a model aircraft. Those helicopters or fixed wings seemed to always break. I'd get one flight, but my son and other youth that are getting into this UAV are seeing, wow, it's simple. They're really enjoying the engineering aspect of it, building them. There's just a lot that goes into it that keeps them engaged. And anything that keeps students engaged, especially in aviation, is a winner to me.
Yeah, definitely happening on the engineering side. I've met several high school students and folks in the first 1 or 2 years of college who have decided to go with an aeronautical engineering program because they've been building drones and in some cases flying model aircraft. So yeah, it's a huge entry point on the engineering side, which is great.
All right, let's move on to our next item. This is concerning Flight 804. This is from CNN. Now, this is about a day old. Egypt fails to pull data from damaged recorders. And what we see here is that Egypt had been unable to pull anything useful from the recorders from Flight 804, and they were planning to send both the cockpit voice recorder and the flight data recorder to the BEA in France, where they will, quote, carry out repair and removal of salt accumulations. Then the black boxes were supposed to be sent back to Cairo for some data analysis. But David, did you find that there's some more recent developments on this?
I'm working on it. You're working. I saw a crawl on CNN saying that they actually had gotten the tapes and recovered the data. Now the data hadn't been analyzed yet. But it was a step in the right direction. It sounds like BEA has actually gotten at least something out of it, and then we'll see what happens from there. And that was CNN, so don't take my word for it.
Yeah, to me, this seems like it opens up the conversation again for having a redundant voice and data recorder system and maybe a system that would eject from the aircraft if something catastrophic were to happen. It just seems like relying on one set of devices just isn't enough.
I think the problem is we'd have these boxes scattered around the runway every time there's a hard landing. Just see them ejecting from the airplane every time you land hard.
Yeah, I'm just looking in the news to see if there's anything more recent on the condition of the recorders, and I don't find anything, but we'll certainly be following this. As we've said before, the recorders are kind of key in terms of understanding what happened during this accident, as is the case with just about all of the aviation accidents.
Did you see, speaking of anomalous events, the 777 that landed, I want to say, in Singapore on fire today? Actually, I think it had been flying for 3 hours, saw engine oil indications, turned around, And shortly after it touched down, the entire wing was on fire, and everybody stayed on board while the fire was being put out. And I thought, wow, that's an interesting call, both as a pilot and, you know, passengers, to stay inside the airplane while they're fighting a fire on the outside. But you know, all the reports were everybody remained calm, and I'm just thinking, boy, how would it have been possible? Me if I were the exit.
I know, oh, yeah. I know.
Did you see the picture of I saw some photos. There was a video of it, and it's amazing.
This is not just a little fire.
Exactly. I mean, the whole wings look fully engulfed. Made me wonder if it was, since they'd been dumping fuel, if it was leaked fuel that was left on the surface, and maybe it wasn't as bad as it seemed. But boy, it looked really bad.
It really did look bad. And we had a bit of a conversation about this today in the Slack listener team. And my comment is very often when there's a fire associated with an oil leak or fuel in or around the engine, a lot of times it's a maintenance issue. Often, something wasn't reconnected or wasn't, torqued properly or, something like that. So, of course, it's way too early to speculate, yet here I do. About what the cause of this might have been, but yeah, I'd certainly expect the recent maintenance history to be a part of the investigation.
Yeah, fire and airplanes—they just don't get along very well.
Bad deal.
Sheesh.
Final news item: Brexit. Everybody's talking about Brexit. Why? Well, because it seems like the Brits have—I don't know what they've done, but. And I say that with love and respect for all of our UK friends, but I think that this has been in the news so much that everybody knows really kind of what the idea here is that Britain is voted to remove themselves from the European Union. Now, the fallout is every place. Certainly, my stock portfolio has taken quite a hit in the last few days.
900 points is a big hit, especially even for us who aren't retired yet.
I know. Yeah, we got to protect that stuff. Although this is not a stock tip show, but
Didn't we talk about gambling earlier and fuel hedging?
Yeah, same, very similar, huh? Very similar. But there are a number of articles out there talking about the effect of this on aviation, on aerospace and defense. There's an article in the Telegraph, Brexit could harm, or would harm, rather, UK's £56 billion aerospace and defense industry. This is actually an article that came out before the vote, and it noted that there was a poll of the ADS, the Trade Association, Industry Trade Association, and the 900 members polled. Only 2% of them were in favor of leaving the European Union. So that was kind of telling about the the hopes and expectations of aerospace. Airline stocks are down. American Airlines shares went down 6.5%. Delta went down 3.7%. United down 4.7%. Southwest didn't do as poorly. Neither JetBlue. They don't have quite the European or international route structure. It's a series of articles showing that this may not be the greatest thing for aviation.
I saw that Ryanair had said they expect with the drop in the pound, which has gone down significantly, that there'll be less leisure travel originating from Britain. So they're expecting people who are boarding flights in England to go down. Over the weekend, I had a great conversation with my friend Alan Brown, who's was the F-117 fighter program manager, and he was just livid. I mean, he just thought that this was he's from Britain, by the way, and he just thought that this was going to be really bad for British aerospace. He points out that they assemble a lot of Eurofighters there, and that the Eurofighter is split up so that one wing comes from Spain, one wing comes from Italy, a major part of the fuselage comes from Britain, and then each of the countries do their own final assembly. But you can just imagine that if the EU decides to do less sourcing of the Eurofighter in Britain, this could have a huge impact on jobs. Now I'm guessing it wouldn't be overnight, but long term, this is going to be a major change, and I think it's going to take a while before everything settles out and we fully understand the impact of this.
Seth Miller wrote a great piece in the Runway Girl Network, And he points out that it's kind of a double whammy from the standpoint of you have stock prices dropping, you have the exchange rate effect, and how that, as you say, Max, affect the travelers. This could have a really debilitating effect on the airlines that serve that market. We see, in that article, I think he says that IATA says they expect a 3.5% drop in total passenger numbers for the UK in the next 3 years as a result of this.
Well, the demographics of who voted to stay and who voted to go was rather interesting. I think they said that the people who voted to stay tended to be younger, more educated, and more based in the cities. And the older, less educated, more rural folks were more inclined to vote to leave. So that's kind of an interesting stratification right there.
Yeah, very much.
And Northern Ireland and Scotland. Scotland is... They voted to stay in the EU, and Northern Ireland is suddenly talking to the rest of the island to see if they can merge, and Scotland wants to secede from England, and they've had that vote before, and it was a vote to stay, but now they're not so sure.
Interesting.
And I read that Wales is one of the single largest recipients of transfer payments from the EU, just because it's largely rural and the economy is poor relative to other countries. Hard to believe, but they actually receive more money than some of the Eastern European countries, and so they potentially stand to lose billions in transfer payments if they're no longer part of the EU.
Another aspect of this we might see is the effect on open skies agreements, treaties that are out there, both between Britain and the EU, which might have to be renegotiated as a result of this. Also, treaties between the UK and the US. That may change, all of that and require renegotiation of those treaties, which that's something that seems almost unimaginably difficult to me to have to start over with those kind of treaties.
Yeah, just think about the amount of time and energy that's going to get devoted to this, both by politicians and business leaders, when they could be working on other more productive things. I mean, I think this is just a real huge hit to productivity to have to renegotiate things that, have been working fine in the past. But it'll be interesting to see. Some folks are now having buyer's remorse and saying they want to vote again. I can see why.
Yeah, I could certainly see why. I don't know if the mechanism is there to allow it or if they're stuck with this result. I just don't know.
Somebody was saying that Parliament has to finally approve it. This was only the first step, that Parliament has to approve it. So maybe they'll figure out a way to backtrack. I will say, though, one of the headlines that we were seeing over the weekend that was the scariest thing to me was, as the polls were closing, people were Googling the phrase EU and what does it mean to leave the EU after people have voted, which is kind of terrifying.
Yeah, you sort of want to know that when you go into the polling booth.
Can you imagine a country with uninformed voters? Huh. I mean, that's just shocking.
In this day and age, who can believe
it? I was going to say, hey, at least they took the time to find out, even if it was after the fact.
Exactly.
But uninformed voters with a 75% vote rate.
Yeah, the turnout was very high.
Oh, is that right?
Huh. So you have to give the Brits credit. 75% of the population voted in this thing. And which is more than we can say here in the States when a good year is 25%. Mm.
Except that that actually might be an indicator of the percentage of people there that aren't thinking clearly. It may be a high turnout, but not the kind of thinkers that you really want to have directing the world economy in this kind of way.
Well, it's interesting that it was so evenly split. What was it, 52-48? That's pretty darn close. And that actually, is similar to kinds of major splits we see in this country over things. So it just kind of tells me that, Britain is a diverse population, much like we are here in the United States.
Again, we're speaking with Matt Johnson, the president of California Aeronautical University. Matt, what motivated you to want to start a university?
Good question. But so my father was an accounting instructor, and then he spent his career in education administration. So I guess you could say that education is in my blood. And I started teaching some in the evening, not long after graduating from college. And the rest is history. Now I'm pursuing my efforts, making a difference in the aviation community by bringing, you know, California Aeronautical University to the market, which has been quite an endeavor, you know, the past four years of working on it.
So how is the university differentiated from other options that students might have?
That's a good question. There's a lot of options you'd think out there in the market, but the biggest barrier is educating people that there are options. So one of the main things we're doing is spending a lot of time putting ourselves out in front of people, primarily in, you know, the Western states at this point. But we offer a complete solution. There's no surprises of cost or extra flight certificates or ratings needed, including your private pilot, your instrument, commercial, single engine, multi-engine add-on, your CFI, your CFII. All the books and supplies are included, so no surprises with checklists, knee boards, in-aircraft headsets. You know, just you show up and you focus on your courses and your flights, and then we work to get you placed out there in the career that you want to pursue, whether it's the airlines or otherwise. You mentioned earlier, we are 141 approved, so our graduates not only get the structured curriculum for all their flight and ground courses, but they're also eligible to make application for their restricted ATP with a bachelor's degree at 1,000 hours and an associate's degree at 1,250, which, you know, as you know, with the 1,500-hour rule that's gotten so much discussion in the aviation community over the years, that's a big reduction of time necessary to reach that milestone. So equipment, we're using new Cessna 172 G1000 aircraft. We are using for the twin Baron 55s. It's a little faster and kind of more realistic twin experience. And then we use Redbirds, MCX, and SDs. And then we have a couple Frasca Baron ATDs as well. So those are a couple things. But, you know, being the new kids of the block, too, how do we differentiate ourselves with, you know, the others is cost. We're really trying to keep our costs down. We recognize that that's the biggest barrier for people pursuing an aviation career. So we try to keep our flight training as reasonable as possible, but still expose them to all of the new equipment and kind of state-of-the-art training. So we're pretty focused on keeping those costs down. And then, yeah, of course, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to ask if you were using Max Trescott's book on the G1000.
What book? Hey, we'll have to talk about that, Max. Maybe there's a place to at minimum get you in as a guest speaker, right?
I thought this was an unsponsored broadcast here, but thank you, Brian.
Yeah, I was just wondering.
What the heck?
Yeah, no, so... And again, in the spirit of keeping costs down, if your book's free, I think we definitely have a conversation we could have.
It might be a short conversation in that case.
Yeah. Yes. The last thing that I think is probably the largest differentiator is if you look on the map at where a lot of universities are located, or, you know, the institutions where you can go get the types of things we offer. There's not too many located here in Southern California with the facilities that we have. So, you know, location, location, location. Ah. Southern California, you know, you get the year-round weather in Bakersfield, where the 22-acre campus is located right on Meadows Field there. It's year-round flying with mountains, desert. And then, of course, you know, we pop over the mountain range over to get some coastal flying. And airspace is big. It's not congested airspace, so... people aren't sitting, waiting to launch. Number one, from an airport that's congested or airspace that's just got a lot of density to it, so students can go from the ramp to the air relatively rapidly, find one of their training boxes, and complete their lessons. So we're pretty pleased with the whole package, and think that, if students and families alike check us out, that they'll see they can get a lot more from what we have to offer.
Bakersfield is the campus that just recently opened, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, we took possession last August of a 22-acre purpose-built flight training facility. It was the old, I don't know if you're familiar with International Flight Training Academy. It was ANA Airlines Pilot Training Center. So, yes. Yeah, it's a beautiful facility. We've got a training, two-story educational building. You've got 168 single occupancy on-site dormitory rooms. You've got recreation center with a 25-meter pool, basketball, tennis, volleyball, 300-person cafeteria, a flight line that has 32 shade spots for aircraft, and about a 40,000 square foot five-bay hangar space. It's going to be perfect for our A&P program in the future.
So you have room for flight instructors? Because Rob and I are thinking of moving down there.
Yeah, we've got some dorm rooms left. You guys could make a go of it.
Well, just remember, if you include food for free, we'll be there. I mean, that's how most flight instructors get compensated these days.
Yeah, I was going to say, we all work for food.
Matt, I was going to ask, did you have any difficulty identifying flight instructors and faculty, staff, and so forth?
Yeah, in the phase we're in now, our first graduates will see this winter, and we can't wait till they graduate, because then we start kind of producing our own flight instructors. But as I'm sure you guys have talked about on this show, that's a big challenge right now. So finding flight instructors that can come in and not follow the lines to the airlines is a big challenge.
You mentioned ANA. Is that was the prior owner actually training people from ANA Airlines in Japan?
Yeah. So ANA Airlines used to, for 20 years. So the facility was built 20 years ago by ANA. They did an extensive search in all of the United States, and were trying to identify where to make their investment. You know, what marketplaces for airspace and proximity to different things. And they selected Bakersfield because of all the things I mentioned earlier. And for 20 years, they sent all of their pilots over to this facility. And they did about a two-year stint there, where then they get sent back and go on their line and start flying for them.
And are you associated with any of the major airlines in Asia or other parts of the world? In other words, do you have a large percentage of foreign students as part of your clientele?
We have not focused on that. We're really working to kind of serve the domestic market, because we think that there's a lot of flight academies that are out there, and there's a lot of dependency even in some of the more traditionals that we would be competing with that are under contract. We've heard stories under contract with foreign carriers. We've heard stories where domestic students that have gone off to study in 3 months and they've only gotten like 6 hours of flight time because aircraft are dedicated to foreign contracts or other things, and just not the availability on the line for them to get their flight time in. So we're going to stay focused on the domestic students initially, and I'm sure like everyone at some point will be approached with some interesting contract to fly some foreign carrier, or provide some training for a foreign carrier.
When the students graduate, how many hours will they have?
They'll get all their certificates and ratings they need to go right into flight instruction. And the minimum that they can get from us is 258, but not too many people hit the minimums. And so the maximum we kind of budget or package a student with is as high as 340 hours. So what we're finding is most of the students are probably going to be punching closer to 300 hours, somewhere in between that minimum and maximum.
Matt, I'm curious. How do you fund, you know, a startup like this?
Well, if your listeners can just go to this website and make donations. No, I'm just kidding.
Ah, same as this podcast. Perfect.
Yeah. The same way your podcast is supported. Actually, we are budgeted based on our tuition and fees that students and families put forth for their education. So we're in a growing state right now. We've contracted with Cessna for delivery of 7 aircraft. We'll have our 5th aircraft from Cessna delivered at the end of July. And then we have a Baron 55 for the twin and the Redbird and the Frasca ATDs. It's definitely a rallying of resources.
I imagine.
And these are all new aircraft?
The Cessna primary trainers are new aircraft, yes.
I'm curious, why go with the new aircraft versus getting something used and kind of going the Delta route and saving just a ton of money by getting used aircraft?
Well, that's a great question, and a lot of dialogue took place regarding that because that's the easy way to go, you'd think. But first, you've got to find, you know, a standardized used fleet or be able to invest in standardizing a used fleet. So we felt very strongly in the primary trainer that we wanted an aircraft that was dependable, that we, you know, had a proven history in flight training. And then the Cessna was the obvious choice for us. Then is the second dialogue of, okay, what instrumentation do you use? Do you use, you know, your six pack, or do you move to the G1000 route? And given that our curriculum and our programs are really geared towards developing professional pilots, they're going to experience mostly glass in their professional career. So the G1000 was the natural choice, and they'll get exposed to the six-pack experience through some of their add-on training with the twin and some of their upset training for CFI and things like that.
So when the students go through the program, do you fill all 4 seats, and do other students get to observe? Or when the student flying goes up, are they by themselves or just with the instructor?
So all of the above. We have most of our lessons through our training course outlines that are approved. We have dual instruction occurring. And then for the commercial segments, there's a lot of, you know, time building, and we do see our students, you know, traveling with one another, making different legs for their trip. One flies there, one flies back. We've seen as many as, you know, 3 students depart together, but, you know, they're very conscientious about the weight and balance and making sure that their flights are sensible. So with the 172. Getting 3 in there is about max with some of the density altitudes that we're dealing with in summer in Bakersfield, if not over, if you don't fuel manage. But we also allow our students and have part of the curriculum where they can go up at no cost and just be a passenger, sit in the back seat. So there's a lot to be gained from a student just taking some rides as a passenger, especially early on in their private, to just listen to the radio, know that they're not alone with somebody else making mistakes, watching the instructor make corrections to the pilot in command. When they're in the back seat, they can kind of build their confidence in knowing that, you know, this is just an evolution in the training process, and hopefully perform better having been a passenger watching somebody else perform.
Matt, how do you handle maintenance? Is that something that's done internally, or do you subcontract that out? I'm imagining that there are, you know, many aviation jobs that are associated with supporting a university operation like this. And how does it work for the maintenance part of it?
So we have our own maintenance staff. We have an A&P IA on staff, so he's responsible for all the maintenance to the aircraft. And then we can kind of go back earlier to our selection of new aircraft. Obviously, bringing them in new from Cessna, we get some warranty support, and you're just dealing with an aircraft that you know that doesn't come with all the bugs and hidden secrets that somebody else knows.
Are all your students in a degree program of some type? In other words, do you have some people who are only working on a pilot's license, or is that always in conjunction with some degree? And what degree do people typically pursue?
Yeah, so we have an associate's degree and a bachelor's degree, and most of our students, all of our students, are pursuing one of those two degrees in commercial pilot. So the associate degree is a degree in aeronautics or aviation studies, and the bachelor's degree is a degree in aeronautics. And we don't offer any flight training to anyone that's not pursuing a degree. So we're 100% focused on kind of the degree pursuing student and allocating resources accordingly. We've had several questions from people in the community to say, well, would you allow me to just get my private pilot, or can I come in and, you know, work my own pace like I can find in an FBO? And we're not inclined to want to do that because, you know, earning, you know, weekend amount of money from somebody on an aircraft that is really meant to resource for a student that's dedicated to your degree program, we want to keep the resources dedicated to those students. So degree-focused students only at this point.
Is there an accreditation process for that? David, do you remember when we were talking about this accreditation question with respect to UAV training, and we were seeing some organizations, some companies are spring up to offer drone training, and some of them had better reputations than others. And we were, you know, wondering what's the mechanism, or is there even a mechanism for accreditation, or, you know, some organization that puts their blessing on schools so that they're, they can be evaluated in that way. Is there something similar for aviation schools, or is it the same as for any educational institution?
Yeah, there's actually many, many steps in that process. Obviously, first you have to be, kind of an established entity of some sort. So we are a private institution, and then you have to receive approvals from your state. So we have state approval to operate as an educational institution. And then the Department of Education, which allows access to students having federal funds available to them. So Pell Grants, parent loans, student loans of various types, et cetera, needs to approve the institution as well. And they do that through a number of bodies of accreditors, and those accreditors, we've been accredited for over 30 plus years, actually since the early 70s, and so more than that. Coordinating all of those things together, along with the FAA approvals that are necessary to deliver Part 141 education, has been quite the process for sure.
Yeah, I imagine. Boy, what a task that is. Well, what's the FAA involvement like? Is there some kind of recurring audit or anything like that on the part of the FAA once they issue the approvals to you?
Yeah, the process is you prepare your curriculum, your training course outlines, and you submit an application to the FAA. Our local jurisdiction falls under the Van Nuys FISDO, and it's assigned to somebody to review your application, and they come out and, you know, have to have your chief pilot and assistant chief pilot and your appropriate staff, and they go through the application to ensure that, you know, everything that you say you're going to do, you're going to do, or you have systems in place to do. And they come on site and they take a look at your equipment. They take flights with your chief pilot or whoever they might choose. And it was a many, many month process, but we're fortunate that the local Van Nuys FISDO has been very cooperative, and we're very pleased with our working relationship with the FAA at this point.
Max Trescott, is there sort of an equivalent process for you as a flight instructor?
Oh, it's much, much simpler.
I would imagine.
What Matt has just described there. Part of what he's describing is the process that a Part 141 flight school would go through. And that's schools which are allowed to offer pilot training with less than the full minimum of hours that are typically required. A lot of flight schools, I would say probably the majority, are not Part 41 like Matt's, and they're Part 61. And that's a lot simpler to get set up as a flight school for that, because then the FAA relies pretty much on the individual flight instructors to provide the curriculum and the training. But Matt's got me intrigued here. I'm thinking of starting up a university as well. So my question is, when I do that, can I give myself a whizzy title like chancellor? I mean, could you call yourself the chancellor of CAU?
Yeah, we'll give you a robe and everything.
Well, that's it. I'm in.
Yeah, it's we all wish it was that easy, right?
And what about the chair? I mean, don't you get a special chair or something like that, an endowed chair?
Yeah, we'll make sure we can do something special for you.
No, I'm talking about you. I have a swivel chair, and that's fine.
Yeah, no. Surprisingly, my chair swivels as well. So
there's
more paperwork, and really, at the end of the day, you've got to respect all the processes that are ultimately there to look out for the quality of education for the students, and making sure you have the qualified personnel to be instructing these courses. I mean, we have in our curriculum crew resource management, advanced aviation concepts, aviation weather, aerodynamics, avionics and components, aviation law, flight safety, just to name a few. And you've got to find all the qualified instructors that can, instruct in these areas, and these different agencies just make sure you're finding the right people and doing what you say you're doing.
Matt, being in Bakersfield, do you have an issue getting those instructors, or is there a large local pool to choose from?
So far we've hired back several people that were part of the ANA training facility. They were fortunately, still in the Bakersfield area. So our chief pilot has stayed in Bakersfield, and we were fortunate to find him. And then I think also there's not too often that universities like this kind of crop up, and we're kind of, as we're becoming known in the aviation community, something a little special. We're not your brand name universities that are out there that, most people are familiar with in the aviation community. And we're not your mom and pop FBO. We're kind of positioned pretty nicely in the middle to be able to give all that personal attention that, somebody needs from a small university and still get the university kind of campus feel. And yet we can offer all of the certifications and ratings and degrees that your main reputable long time in the industry universities have provided. So when people hear that story and they start kind of wanting to be part of this new thing, we've been able to attract some people from other parts of the country to come out and join us.
Matt, I was talking with a really close friend of mine here over the last day, and she mentioned that you often bring an RV out to air shows full of flight simulators. So you probably know I'm talking about Vicky Benzing. Tell me about the relationship that CAU has with this air show pilot.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I mentioned earlier, the big challenge that we find. I think the people listening to this podcast probably are largely within the aviation community. And some of the challenges that the aviation community has is getting outside of our community and educating everyone else about all of the different opportunities and exciting career paths that exist in aviation. And I was fortunate to be able to spend some time and meet Vicky Benzing just over a year ago. I'm familiar with her because of my role on the Camarillo Air Show board and being involved with that for many years. But got to talking with Vicky, and we saw kind of an alignment in terms of what we'd like to do, and getting the word out there. And, you know, she's just exciting with her Stearman as well as her extra 300 and her performances. So we thought, what a great way to kind of get the word out there and attract people to associate ourselves with somebody that's kind of local to the West Coast here. And so we are a sponsor of Vicky, and you can see her performing and the CAU stickers on the side of her aircraft, and, you know, she'll sign autographs. And we take a simulator bus that we have, two flight simulators, and we set that up at air shows, and we go to high schools, and we do all types of things with it that just try to excite people about getting interested in aviation. So this bus has been an incredible resource. We just have all kinds of demand for it, and we cycle easily 200 to 500 people through an air show flight experience for free. So if you're out at an air show and on the West Coast, look for our bus. We might be there.
Wow. Yeah, we really enjoyed having Vicky on the show as our guest back in episode 374, I think it was. Really phenomenal pilot, phenomenal woman.
Yeah, she's got a real passion for education and a real strong interest in youth. And, you know, when you see her autographing, and she's a female pilot, and we need more female pilots to get interested. We need more females, just period, to get interested in aeronautical pursuits. So Vicky's a great, great role model for that. We're proud to be associated to her.
Yes, and you should. Yes. Speaking of that, how is the makeup, the student makeup, male, female, age wise? What's the demographics of the typical student body there?
So we've got a couple different audiences, primarily the high school, younger, just out of high school student. And then we've got also a strong military interest. So the military provides good, strong benefits to our military veterans and alike, their families. We participate in the Yellow Ribbon Program, which basically provides a reduction of tuition to military students. And those two audiences are primarily who are serving. Aviation, and especially this program we're offering now with the pursuit for a professional pilot, it's kind of a young person's path. You kind of got to get in early. The airlines want to make their investment, I think. Well, who knows? With the demand and the shortage for pilots in the coming years, and there's all kinds of statistics to support that, who knows? Maybe they'll be taking people like myself if I want to start pursuing a career in.
And Matt, are you offering any classes at night, or is it daytime only right now?
Yeah, thanks for asking. We offer all of our kind of academic portion of the courses at night, and the flying is largely done during the day, during the week. So our university is set up on a quarter system that cycles every 10 weeks. So we're a year-round university. So every 10 weeks, a student is progressing with some flight accomplishment, as well as their academic achievements in the different general education or aviation-related courses that they take. And then the associate degree can be completed in 70 weeks, and the bachelor's degree just around double that. Our students are dedicated. They're there full-time. If they have a job, they're working on the weekends, or they're trying to fit it in between their flights during the week.
So really, getting a bachelor's degree in approximately 2.5 years, that seems fairly accelerated.
It's very accelerated. Again, we're year round. Every 10 weeks, we're starting a new quarter. And yeah, just around 3 years, you can obtain your bachelor's degree.
Well, any school could do that. They just cut out the drinking, right? Wouldn't that save a year right there?
Yeah, well, yeah, that's half of it, right? The holidays, the spring breaks. But fortunately, with an aviation university, we've got a little edge that that stuff isn't tolerated so much.
Yeah, boy, no wonder it took me 9 years to get my bachelor's.
Oh. Too many spring breaks, Brian. Yeah.
Matt, tell us where we can learn more about California Aeronautical University.
Yeah, it's been great spending time with you guys, and thanks for taking the time to learn about us. But if your listeners would like to learn more about our university, they can visit our website at calaero.com, and we have a 3D tour of our campus, and they can learn more about our program offerings and see everything about us. Or they can call us by telephone at 661-615-5915, and we'd be happy to talk with you and tell you how you can start attending.
Matt Johnston, thank you so much. Now it's time for our What's Up with the Geeks segment. David, let's start with you. You've gotten some notoriety lately.
Well, yeah, I was in USA Today or USA Today Online. They sent out a call for people to pick the 20 favorite or best air shows in the United States. I and Ron Rapp, who was in episode 301, were selected to provide the list. There's a list of 20 air shows, and you can go and pick your favorite air show now through July 18th, and then they'll give the results on July 22nd. So there'll be a link to the show notes. About 60% of the choices were on my list, so the rest were Ron's. So it was kind of a neat nomination and an interesting process. And my wife was kind of dumbfounded that I pulled the 20 list out of my head within about 10 minutes.
Not surprised at all, David. that sounds like classic David Vanderhoof to me.
Yeah, it's kind of like name every aircraft the Blue Angels ever flew. Name the top 20 air shows in the United States. Right. Yeah, well, you know. And then everybody said, well, why didn't you pick any in Canada? I said, because there's only one air show I want to go to in Canada, and that's the Vanderhoof International Air Show in British Columbia. So, there's not many people who can say they have an air show named after them. So,
right.
I'm good with that. So, on to, I guess, Rob.
Who's not here, but we'll promote this for him because I think it's kind of exciting. We'll have a link to this in the show notes. Award nominated NBAA video anchors NBAA's single pilot safety resources. And this is Rob's video. It's titled Alone in the Cockpit. I think we might have mentioned this before. It's a 10-minute video. So congratulations to Rob for being nominated, and we'll put a link in the show notes to the article about that where you can also watch the video. All right, Max West, how are you doing these days? You've been a little busy, have you?
I am doing awesome. I'm not going to talk about aviation. I'll talk about something personal, which is Yahoo! One of my daughters got married, and that was just a fabulous weekend down near Santa Cruz. And as I mentioned to you guys, as we were just getting ready to start the show, I thought for sure something would have to go wrong. There would be, you know, something with an event like this that didn't go. But no, it was just it was a perfect weekend. Everything went off without a hitch. Everybody was relaxed and comfortable, and no.
It was a hitch, wasn't it? hitched.
No, they did. Absolutely. That was the one hitch, and it worked great. So anyway, just want to let Mr. and Mrs. Fry know that we love them, and we're happy that they're back in Boston pursuing their careers, and hope they come back and see us soon.
Wonderful. Brian, what's going on with you?
Well, I kind of have a question for the listener community as a result of my flight back from D.C.,
Okay.
So this one was real interesting, and I'm really torn over what to do and how to handle this. So on the flight back, I was fortunate enough to get upgraded, and I was flying on a 777 in business class, which was really nice. And as part of that benefit, you get to order cocktails for free. So I order a cocktail and have another one, and the third one came. And at that point, the flight attendant brought one of the mini bottles instead of having the drink pre-made. And the bottle, I noticed the seal was broken on it, and I didn't know if she opened it for convenience for me or what was going on. So I decided to just sample, just, you know, taste. I dipped my finger on the top of the bottle.
Yeah.
And it was water. So I'm just wondering, was this a bottle that she emptied because she thought that I had too much? Or is this the catering staff stealing liquor and refilling bottles or what? And so my question to the listeners is, what should I do with this bit of information? Should I let United know about this, or should I just shut up and chalk it up to something crazy?
Or is this a fish story where... you know, you claim you only had three, but maybe there was a lot more and it just started tasting like
right,
water.
That's right.
Yeah.
I would have asked her on the spot, hey, why, or him, you know, why is the seal cracked on this? And, you know, get their explanation right there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I didn't, and I definitely flubbed it on that, but I'm just sort of curious as to what our listeners would do or what advice they can give me to help me out with this dilemma.
I would say start traveling less, right? Don't fly as much.
Yeah, and I looked it up. I have 78,023 miles on United so far this year.
Amazing. All right. And if you've got any advice for Brian on that, it's brian@airplanegeeks.com. All right. Now we've got a listener recording. This is from Carlos. He's a listener, but he's also an aviation podcaster himself, of course, from the Plane Talking UK podcast. And so let's hear what Carlos has to say.
Hi, geeks. It's Carlos here over in the Plane Talking UK studios. So I've been listening to your show, as you know, since, well, episode one, and thoroughly enjoy listening to you guys talk aviation every week. It's part of my podcast diet, and it will be for as long as you guys keep producing content. A special thanks to Rob Mark for coming on the show a few weeks back. Me and Matt really enjoyed having Rob on the show. And not to make Rob's head grow too big, but so far Rob's appearance on the show has been our second biggest download through the server. So congrats, Rob. So I thought I'd send in some feedback. Well, it's kind of a story, really. And it goes back to 1989, and I was, well, considerably younger then, and enjoying the holidays away in foreign countries, as I did do more than twice a year, thanks to my father. And this particular holiday in question was to the island of Malta, and we were flying with Air 2000, an airline which has since finished and ceased operations here in the UK. But they are a charter airline, and we flew from Gatwick to the island of Malta for a week. I had a fantastic holiday, and I can still remember, even that far back, as a child, loving the flight there. And, you know, it was one of those things that kind of sparked the big love of aviation for me, seeing this... wonderful 757-200, which was then fairly new to the airline. So the big story comes on our return journey. We were flying back into Gatwick on our end of our week's holiday. And again, we were on board the Air 2000 757, which was a 200 series. And the registration back then was Gulf Oscar 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 Hotel. Air 2000 had got this Boeing 757 in April 1989. It was delivered to them. And there was me flying this back in the passenger cabin, flying on this aircraft back to the UK. It was a night flight, so there wasn't much to see outside. And as a child back then, the first thing I'd done, as most children did do before 9/11, was ask your parents, or to push that wonderful call button above your head to ask to speak to a flight attendant. So I did this, put my hand up, pressed a button, boom, and the flight attendant came across. We'd only just reached cruise altitude, so the flight hadn't been in the air long. But I plucked up the courage to ask the flight attendant myself, "Is there any chance I could go up on the flight deck to see the captain?" She gave a smile and said that she'd go back and ask and come back and give me the news. So as you can imagine, as a child back then in 1989, I was extremely happy about this prospect of being allowed to go on the flight deck of a 757. And within minutes of asking, she came back, and the answer was yes. So I picked up myself, grabbed my dad's 8mm camcorder, and walked up to the flight deck with the flight attendant. She opened the door and put me inside and closed the door behind me. And there was me, left with the captain and first officer on board this Boeing 757-200. I couldn't believe the amount of lovely, awesome display screens inside this aircraft. None of your dials that I'd seen previously on the TriStars. Although the TriStar is always going to be my favourite. But hey. But this aircraft was an array of just display screens and digital readouts and stuff. It was amazing. So I sat there and chatted to the pilots, as I always have done in the past and did do in the future up till 9/11. And we were talking about the different buttons and what they did and how they fly. And, well, it was amazing. They were showing me stuff out of the window, you know. And this was at a time when it was firework night here in the UK. So there were fireworks in the sky below, which you could just see out of the window. It was a lovely clear night. So I was up there for a good half an hour. And they let me sit in the jump seat and just watch. And I was in awe of what these pilots were doing. And just, it was amazed at just how wonderful experience this really was. So with that, I said, I better get back to my mum and dad, who were patiently waiting for me back in the cabin, no doubt having a few beers and a glass of wine. Back then, Air 2000 was quite a good airline, and was sadly missed when it went away. But with this, I got up, said my goodbyes. But before I had a chance to leave a flight deck, the captain turned round to me and asked a question that I'll never forget. He said, "Would you like to come up here when we land at Gatwick and sit in the jump seat?" Whew. Well, that was a question that I remember didn't take me long to answer, but I remember saying, "I better ask my parents first, is that okay?" To which he said, "Yes, that's fine." So I opened the door, the flight deck door myself, walked back out of the cabin, down to the back of the aircraft where we were seated, and asked my parents, "Can I go back up when we land at Gatwick?" There wasn't no going to be any sort of no at all to that aunt or that question. It was an immediate yes from my parents. So I waited and we enjoyed the rest of our flight, only a few hours. And then just before we landed, I went back up to the flight deck, opened the door, went in, closed the door, and sat up on the jump seat. The captain and co-pilot turned round and helped me put my seatbelt on. This wasn't quite like the seatbelts we got back in the cabin. These were proper seatbelts, proper captain and first officer seatbelts, which were amazing. And the seat had that glorious fleecy lining that the seats have on board the Boeing aircraft. I can always remember just how comfortable that seat was. So after strapping in, belting up, and camera in hand, I might add at this point, the Sony 8mm Handycam, I can always remember, we proceeded to, well, line up to land at Gatwick Airport. Bear in mind, this was a night flight, so I could see everything out the window. All the Thames coming over London, and then gradually when we lined up to Gatwick, I could see the runway lights in the distance, which was quite a sight to behold. So with this, I had my camera ready to go, and I filmed every last second of that run into Gatwick Airport. And it was just an amazing experience. I still have the video. It's on, if those of you can remember, VHS. It's on VHS video, and I'm yet to get that converted into digital format, which I hope to do sometime soon. But that flight will never leave my mind. And I always remember when the flight had landed and we got to the gate, it wasn't over then. I carried on filming and the flight crew continued their shutdown procedures and went through their checklists whilst I was filming. And this was just amazing. So I finished filming, said my goodbyes and shook the hand of these wonderful pilots that I see before me, and turned round to leave the flight deck. On opening the door and walking out, the usual hustle and bustle in the cabin just stopped, and everyone turned round and looked at me, walking out of the flight deck. It was a kind of, what the heck are you doing here? But that didn't last long. Everyone was, really eager to get off the flight. So I walked back to my parents and grabbed my bag, and we left the aircraft. What an experience and what a flight. That is definitely one flight that will always, always live in my mind for many, many years. So the aircraft in question, a quick rundown before I finish this quick story. So the aircraft is still flying. It's actually flying with Federal Express, and or FedEx, as you'd like to call. And as I said, it was a Boeing 757 200 series, and the manufacturer's serial number was 24293. The aircraft first flew in March 1989, so when I was on that aircraft, it was relatively new. As of now, the aircraft is 27 years old, still powered by two Rolls-Royce RB211 engines, and it's been through a number of owners since Air 2000, Avianca, Air Canada 3000, Cameroon Airlines. It was stored just briefly for about a year at Victorville in 2008, before it was then took on by Federal Express in 2009 and converted to a freighter in October 2009. The aircraft, now registered November 922 Foxtrot Delta, is still in use with FedEx, but that aircraft will always have fond memories to me, and I hope it still continues to fly for many years to come. Even being 27 years old, it's still a fantastic aircraft. And after the TriStar, will be my second favourite aircraft in my top five list, I think. Well, that's it. A bit of feedback from me, Carlos, over here in the UK at the Plane Talking UK Studios. So I'm going to leave you now and let you guys get back to the fantastic show you produce each week. Continue the great work and take care. Goodbye.
Wow. Thanks, Carlos.
Hey, fun story, huh?
Yeah, what a great story.
Yeah, you know what my takeaway is? My takeaway is if any of us ever have an opportunity to give a youngster an aviation experience of any kind, really, we really should do it because, you can hear it in Carlos' voice. He said it, but you could also hear it how that left a lifelong impression on him. And, every once in a while, each of us has an opportunity to do that, and we should take that opportunity. That's my takeaway.
Yeah, there's an unwritten rule among pilots when we're taxiing along by an airport. You are required to wave at the kids. I mean, I'll open the door of the airplane, and of course I could do that because I'm the flight instructor and somebody else is doing the work. And, just make sure they see me waving at them. And boy, you always get an enthusiastic response. And you just know that, somewhere that's the beginning of someone's love of aviation, just as like it was for Carlos. By the way, it sounds like he loves that 757 so much. If he hits the jackpot, I bet he buys it.
Yeah, maybe we should take up a collection. Yeah. All right. Well, listen, let's move on to a little bit of listener mail really quick. We're running short of time. We have been talking about this issue of mental health exams for pilots. Should we have them? Shouldn't we? How should they be structured and so forth. And we received a little bit of feedback on that topic. First, we have a short recording from Mike Smith. So let's listen to Mike here.
Hi, geeks. The discussion about some kind of mental health check for pilots is an interesting one. As the medical exam process works now, there really isn't a good way to make it work. Here's how the test goes. Fill out the paperwork online, visit the AME, Aviation Medical Examiner, have your exam. If you pass, then the AME signs the form and you walk out of there with a piece of paper that says you're good to go. It's instantaneous. Medically, whether or not you're good to go is, for the most part, objective. You either pass the tests or you don't. Discounting the first flight physical you receive, nearly every pilot that walks in knows if they are going to pass or not, because if they think they won't, then they don't go. For GA pilots that feel they may not pass, they may decide never to get another physical and to instead fly as a sport pilot where all you need is a valid driver's license. But if you go and you don't pass, then under current rules, you cannot exercise the privileges of even a sport pilot ever again. Believe me, pilots will go into an exam only if they know they will pass. For commercial pilots, they of course have to go to the AME, whether they want to or not. So again, you can bet they will have been working on getting any issues sorted out before they go to the AME, because if they fail, they are out of a job right then and there, at least until a lengthy process of review and deliberation by the FAA Aeromedical Office. And that only might get you your privileges back. An AME is a regular doctor in a regular doctor's office who just happens to do flight physicals. There are no mental health professionals in their offices. So imagine a pilot going into an AME and answering a bunch of mental health questions by a doctor who may not be qualified to make a determination on mental health. He tells the pilot that in his subjective opinion, he didn't pass because he has questions about the pilot's mental health. You can imagine how that pilot is going to respond, because that doctor just set that pilot on a collision course with the FAA and the system. And it is a system that is not friendly to the pilot. Best case, the pilot gets mad at the AME and storms out. Worst case, the AME gets assaulted. Human nature, not necessarily a sign that the person is mentally unfit. So the only way to test for mental health is to send pilots to a separate mental health professional. With the U.S. system, that would mean a trip to another professional's office at some other date, extending the process even further. Sometimes we wait a couple of months for an appointment for the AME as it is. Now, I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but I'll bet that an individual who takes the same mental health exam from 10 different mental health professionals might just have one of those professionals give him the thumbs down. So what if you're the poor pilot in good mental health that draws the short straw when 9 out of 10 of those professionals would have pronounced him good to go? My point is that mental health is a bit more subjective than physical health in most cases. So when discussing proposals, just keep in mind how the system works and how catastrophic a subjective mental test might be. Keep up the great podcast. Mike Smith, Maynard, Massachusetts.
Yeah, some really good points there.
He did. And when Rob listened to Mike's recording, he had the same exact same comment about that. So thanks, Mike, for sending that in. Mike's a longtime listener, one of our great listeners. We appreciate listener recordings always. They kind of bring us some different perspectives, and want to thank Mike for that. Okay, with that, this will bring our episode to a close. We want to thank all of you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. I'll reiterate what David indicated earlier, that we really had a fantastic time at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum a week ago, visiting a number of our listeners for the Innovations in Flight Day event. We love doing that. We met a lot of new people, met a lot of old friends, and it was just a fantastic event. Really appreciate all of you came by and said hello. We also want to thank our guest, Matt Johnson, president of the California Aeronautical University. Matt, again, thanks so much. That's calaero.com, correct?
That's correct. They can also find us on social sites too, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter.
All right. We'll have links to all those in the show notes. Okay. Let's see. Let's tell folks where they can find us online. Brian, how do folks get in touch with you?
The best place to get a hold of me is at brian@airplanegeeks.com. And just in case if anyone wants to donate to the Farnborough 2016 fund, that is at airplanegeeks.com/Farnborough2016.
All right. That's coming up fast. And
it is.
We'll appreciate in advance the content that you and Micah as well, actually, are going to get for our listeners. It's going to be very, very exciting. Max Trescott, where do folks find you?
Oh, all the usual places. You can find me on Facebook or Twitter under my name. And the business side of things would be either at g1000book.com or at sjflight.com for anybody who's interested in flying here in the San Francisco Bay Area.
And David Vanderhoof.
You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof, and you can find me on Fridays on the UAV Digest with Max Flight. And if you haven't listened to episode 406, I have to admit that guy Max Flight was probably the best guest we've had on.
No, not me. What a great day that was. And you guys kind of surprised me by saying that I was the next guest up to be interviewed. So, but thank you. I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Twitter a little bit at Max Flight, on LinkedIn somewhat, especially at the UAVDigest.com, as David just said. Also the PaxX podcast with Mary Kirby. Our intro music this episode is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. Our outro is by Bruno Massone. Find his compositions where he incorporates actual aviation sounds with other music. Find him at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening. We'll be right back.